diagram here in a question about relationships. I'm just copying the diagram. This represents two people. A is trying to express his will and is opposed by B. B can represent any superior power whatever, parents, authorities, the state, and the situation to be examined a little more closely results in A trying to put a pincer movement on B because of A's inferior power, and B, by superior power, is imploding into A. The result is that A begins to look, after a series of encounters, internally, something like this. His own attempts at expression are stopped by the superior force applied from outside. The question then goes on to reduce itself down to a simple proposition. How do we go about seeing the forces involved in such a relation? And how do we deduce a necessary working method to transcend that kind of relation? Well, the how question refers to mechanics, to something to do. And there is no method of doing anything other than by raising the level of awareness. So we have to draw our three-part man, head, chest, belly, with the coordinating spine. Down in the belly we have an urge, which is non-verbalized, and therefore unconscious. Unconscious does not mean that we are not aware of it, but means that the mode of awareness is not articulated verbally. And then we have liking and disliking in the feeling department, and we have ideas in the top, idea in the form. Now, how are we going to see the forces involved in a stimulus situation? We can only do it by noting the total reaction of our being, and this is through feeling. Remember, in the evolution of the universe and of a human being, the field is prior to the existence. The existence is the finiting process. The X means out, the other part of the word is this together. Six fold, it means a wheel, divided into six parts. To exist is to be circumscribed. And prior to circumscription, there is the power of infinity. We use paper to represent this power. The movements of the paper are movements of a sentient power. And when the movements so conform themselves to the circumscriber zone, which I represent by the chalk mark on the paper, we have then brought into being a finite existence. Now, this finite existence can be conceived easily in three totally different ways. We can consider the power involved in it, that all beings are power. We can consider the sentiency aspect of the being feels yes or liking and no or disliking, and the being is in a certain form. Idea is a Greek word for form, shape is the section word. The question says, how do we see the forces involved in our relations? The answer is by, first of all, gaining field awareness. We must feel the whole body. It is only through feeling that we can make ourselves aware of the existence of power, that is primary drive, the existence of form, verbal articulation, and the existence of yes, no. I like it, I don't like it. Power is always positive. This is a three-part being, head, chest, belly. The power below in the belly, the intestinal drive of the Bible salesman in the film of Chicago. This power is always positive when it is awake, it never says no. It either says nothing or yes. So this power can only be felt, providing you are not involving your consciousness in identification with thinking processes. When you think concentratedly, you lose awareness of the drive in the belly zone. But this drive is really the original drive that has created the situation that gives rise to form. So really there are no ideas other than forms produced by power. And in the mode of production arises yes, I like it, or no, I don't like it. Quite simply, we restate, when the stimulus comes to any being, as the empty center of the being, the immanent spirit, when the stimulus comes to any being, the strength of the stimulus and the character of the receiving substance determine the mode of reaction. When the stimulus is very, very strong, we represent that in a very black arrow, then the being is overstimulated, the energy comes in faster than it can adjust to, and the result is the being is literally pushed away, displaced progressively. If the stimulus energy comes fairly lightly and easily, then the energy brought can be assimilated by the substance, and the sensation is one of pleasure. When energy comes at us no faster than we can absorb leisurely, and we call it pleasure. When the energy comes too fast, then we call it pain. There is a refusal. The refusal is simply caused by the overloading of the substance by the incoming energy of the stimulus. In drawing or painting, this is very important, because the stress accent on a line or a mass, a tone or a color, actually aggresses against the substance of an observer in certain ways. Color can be so aggressive that it becomes impossible to assimilate. Tone values can be too contrasted to assimilate easily. You can adjust the tone contrast on your TV till your blacks are too black, your lights are too light, and you have retinal difficulty in accommodating it, and you get eye strain. If you balance the grays properly, you can look for longer with less fatigue. We then have a being and the stimulus at three levels. The lowest level, the application of power as such, sheer force striking the being. This is like a fist into the eye. Or if you like, at the lower level, a kick in the belly. If you get such a kick in the belly department, you feel it simply as an application of a force. If you then stimulate with less energy, you can find that the substance itself records in a different zone in the body that the energy coming in can be easily assimilated, and a yes is given to it, and pleasure is derived from the incoming stimulus energy. If you stimulate in another part very heavily, the result is the invasion of the substance with too much energy in the time units available, and the result is a nerve, a refusal, an attempt to stop it. There are nerves in the body that convey only impressions of pain. Some others are specialized in pleasure. When the mind is stimulated by words, the word itself has resonance, both from the written form, that is visual resonance, as when you recognize that a letter D is half a letter O, which is a semicircle, and therefore it resonates with half of the O, and begins to formulate within the mind associations of ideas. In the insane, in schizophrenics and so on, this becomes very, very obvious, that mechanical associations of ideas are occurring and triggering people into making faulty judgments. The question is, how do we see these things? The answer is, first, we feel more carefully, and we deliberately feel in the three levels of our body. If we concentrate field energy, which is the power of which we are made, in the head, we will step up the thinking process. If we concentrate it in the lower parts of the body, we will stimulate appetite of sex and food. If we place it in the chest region, we will find the kind of feeling that we call generally a affection, not in the technical sense that the psychologist used the word, but liking and disliking at the emotional level. So the hard question is, quite simply, learn to feel your being and the activities going on in the body. You know that if you get a sense of loss about anything whatever, you tend to get a drop in the region of the stomach, in the solar plexus. There's a real sensation like going down in a lift suddenly. If on the other hand you had a sensation that you had done a harm that you could not put right, you will find that the sensation is not centered in the same place, but is displaced over a wider area and tends to concentrate somewhere near the ribs. This is because all the processes in the body are really caused by field states in the body. The power field that constitutes the body absolutely is in a continuous state of flux, flowing, and it is also expanding and contracting, most obviously in the act of breathing. Less obviously, if you inhibit your breathing, hold your breath, you will discover that there is another kind of breathing going on, which you can call field breathing. You can inhibit, blow all the air out of your lungs, and hold them contracted, with the air expelled, and you will feel a tendency to expand, and if you conquer it and hold it, you will actually feel that something is pulling out. And this something is not the muscle structures of the chest trying to make you breathe on it. It is actually a field of power which is expanding and which will triumph if you persist in holding your breath. It will overcome your individual determination to hold your breath by making you breathe. If you hold your breath till you faint, which can be done, you may remember that the Everest expedition men did this as an exercise. If you do that, then as soon as you have fainted, this field of energy will make you breathe while you are unconscious. And this, of course, is a life preservation movement. Now, how do we work knowing this fact? First of all, we see that the power level, the belly level, is not subject to analysis by itself. It is not interested in analysis, it is only interested in push. If it is not asleep, it is pushing. So if you try to verbalize the content of the belly level, all you will find is, I want and I am pushing to get what I want. You mustn't expect a more complicated reply from the belly level than the simple, I want and I am determined to get. And when you come into the level of the chest, into the emotional liking, disliking zone, then you find that you have quite simply a duality of yes and no. And we've said before, this is quite simple. The belly is a pure unity of power. The chest level is a duality of yes and no. Now, because of the dialectical fact of the universe, you cannot have an unadulterated yes in a complex, finite situation. If you could find one single element which had a definite characteristic X, and it were pure, so that it had only one effect on your being, then you could say, I will say yes to it or no to it. You could give it an unqualified yes or no, like Christ says, you should let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. But if you come to a being that is made of parts, we say three parts, because of the polarization into posnae and the positive negative of the link factor between the two, when you have a three-part being, although itself is one being, that is, it has a binding line that creates it as a unity and binds the parts of it together, you cannot give an unqualified yes or no to the whole of it, but only to the part of it. So that if you come to a being called positively beautiful, you will find with it that it has a negatively desirable habit to go with its positive beauty. And you may find that it has a certain neutrality, a plus-minus quality, that it tends not to like you or to dislike you to the degree that you would require. If it likes you fully, it would embrace you and devote itself to you. If it dislikes you fully, it would go away and that would be the end of that problem. But there is a neutral element in beings that makes them neither like nor dislike you. so they don't miss you enough when you go away, and they're not joyful enough when you come to see them. This makes it very difficult in a complex situation to see just how you are going to give an unqualified yes or no. And as all the parts are related together functionally, it becomes practically impossible to give a straight yes or no to any of the parts in isolation, because they are not functional in isolation. It then becomes almost impossible to give yes or no to any given existing entity. Therefore, if you are to give an unqualified yes to life, you must have another method of thinking about it in order to guarantee your positivity in situations of themselves either neutral or negative. And this is the concept of the cross, as the Celtic cross of the Christians, which of course is considerably older than historical Christianity, and which is not older than cosmic Christianity. The cosmic logos has for its symbol this cross, the arms of which transcend the circle. The circle represents any finite circumscribed zone. The vertical transcendent arm represents a force that goes beyond the finite, into the finite, and again beyond it. The horizontal represents the extension of substance, the passive aspect of power, transcending the finite substance of the being, entering it, and again transcending it on the other side. Now, if we can see that the essential problem for infinite power is this, the paper is all there is. That is only infinite power. This power is sentient and self-moving. The paper moves itself. In so doing, it produces ripples. These ripples are forms we could analyze in a drawing, and if we wave it from different points, we could make intersection points, and at the intersection points there would be a vortex created, which is the automatic product of opposing forces in a fluid medium. When we see that this is all there is for the paper a problem which it must face. The problem of the fact that although it is infinite power and therefore omnipotent, although it is in its formal motion the totality of all formal possibilities in actuality, and therefore it is omniscience, nevertheless, although it has all power and is all knowing, as soon as it activates itself and circumscribes any zone within its omnipotence and omniscience, it has, by a superstress, brought to be a finite situation in which there is an inside and an outside. Simultaneously, the creation of a boundary, the rotation of a force, circumscribes and thus encloses and limits and excludes infinity, so that at one blow the first creative act of infinity is to produce finity. Creation means finitizing. The cosmic logos, you can tell by the word cosmic itself, tells you about a ka and ma in it, the cosmos, that it is a closed system. That is the circle in which there is no bigger, called by some theologians God. And that is not the God of the Gospel of John, that is a God, namely cosmic logos. That is a being circumscribed like a sphere with an equator and a polar axis. That is the cosmic logos. And because it has come to be circumscribed, it has excluded infinity. And in so doing has reduced itself from omnipotence to finite potency, from omniscience to relative knowledge. If the sphere manages to reduce its frequency back into the absolute level, it ceases to exist as a finite. That's the concept of the Buddhist pursuit of nirvana. Reduce your individual stress to the level of the absolute, make your hay function to the Allah level, and you cease to exist as an individual and therefore constitute no problem. But if you do so, you are not actualizing some of your potentials, namely the negative potentials. All the positive potentials are absolutely eternal. But the negative ones can only be brought to be by superstressing and thus inducing internally to infinity finite. And straight away, absolute free spirit has generated a zone of relative free dome. And freedom itself is a contradiction in terms, namely the free and the dome, the free and the bound. If we rub out the dome, all we have is the free, but the free doesn't exist. We cannot even use the word have. We cannot say we have this free, because have already implies, more obviously in the German haben, to have, implies a finite process. To have, to comprehend, to possess, and so on, are all finite processes. So what human beings are pursuing in the name of freedom is really a contradiction in terms. And consequently, to make an absolute affirmative, we have to learn to affirm a negative. That is, we have to learn to say yes to all the things we're going to say no to. And we have to learn to say it in principle. And when a stimulus comes to any being, and the stimulus is so fast that it hurts the being tends to run away. But if we put inside this being a concept, we'll put an item of Dobbin inside it, we'll put the Star of David inside it and say, this concept means that every time a stimulus divides me, I will see something I did not see before. This is Da and Din. When a dividing energy comes to me, then I see something. So the Star of David tells me, as a governing concept, that when I am being hurt, I am also being educated. And if I can say that the amount of education I receive for a given pain gives me as much form as the pain has given me unpleasantness, then I will affirm the incoming painful energy. And instead of running away from it, I will stand there and let it come. If I'm very greedy, I might actually run onto it. The important thing is that by means of this device, which we can call the affirmation and the acceptance of crucifixion in the situation, we convert all negatives into positives. That is, every rotten situation, every painful situation, every situation we want to get out of, instead of saying those harsh things about them, we affirm they're all very, very good. And this immediately converts all that men call evil into good. In the Bible, it's obvious that he said of God, he can bring good out of evil. How does he do it? He does it by allowing the evil, that is the excess energy in the situation, to produce information. This information enlightens the being. And when a being is very heavy and inert, rotating very slowly and fairly comfortable, if a bit stagnant, when that being is there and stimulus comes very rapidly, it shakes the being. It shakes the being violently and breaks its inertia. So it enlightens. It takes the weight off it and illuminates it simultaneously. By this method, then, you can convert all negatives into a positive. So that this part of the question is answered now. How do we see these things? We see by becoming more and more feeling conscious of the different levels of our own being. Our own being was originally a sphere, an egg. The egg was polarized, the spinal axis laid down, a diaphragm is put across it, and then the part is divided into two, and top part pushed up to become the head. So a human being is made out of a sphere. And this sphere has a potential human in the field around it. Not inside the egg, in the nucleus of the egg, not in the so-called chromosomes or the genes thereon, but in the field surrounding these things, the human being is there pressing into the form and out to express itself. Now, we have another question here we can tie up with this. This question is called the question in music, because it keeps hiding in the role of faith. It was stated that Uspensky never got from Gurdjieff that language without which man cannot begin to think. It was stated that this was because he was deficient, and nothing is given to the deficient. How does this apply to us? Our presence here advertises our deficiency. That's pause for a commercial, actually. Well, Gurdjieff, of course, was a supreme leg puller, and when he made a statement like that, he knew there was a lot of men, each one of which would individually be called a dummkopf, would misinterpret what he was saying. To be deficient is to be lacking part of the verb to do or make. It means to be not actualizing one's potentialities. When he said that Uspensky hadn't been given this because he was deficient, he could have equally well said the same thing about any other being, providing he did not say in what part of his being he was being deficient. Even Gurdjieff was being deficient when he died of a disease for which he was being treated, and the treatment was not effective. He wasn't lifted up on the mountain top, suffused with glory, and carried away before an admiring crowd, and photographed by telecameras. He was, in fact, deficient at the moment of death. The finite, as we have just seen, is deficient, because to exist as a finite is to be deficient. So when it says, the language is that which man cannot begin to think, it's a very, very nice statement, but it wants modifying a little. That language is that which man cannot begin to think in the way that he would like to think if he knew what that mode of thought could do for him. That would be better. And as for deficiencies, a man is deficient in general on one of the three levels. He's either deficient in power, sexual drive, appetite for din-din, hurry back home soon for two reasons, and deficient in emotions. He doesn't really know if he likes it or dislikes it, because he hasn't got strong liking or disliking, or he's deficient in rational capacity. Broadly, you can examine yourself for a specific deficiency, your special deficiency, what he would have called chief point. Most people are deficient in some part of their being more than another part, and this deficiency constitutes their individual characteristic. If you imagine a person with no deficiencies whatever, he must be absolutely perfect. If there is another being of the same order, he must be indistinguishable from the first being. And for this reason it is said that the objective universal truth perceived by the sages is identical. But the finite existential being of the sages on earth, their physical body, is far from being an identical object. Gautama Buddha at 80 died of an internal disorder. Having attained nirvana spiritually did not stop his physical body becoming worn out. An old Jewish friend of mine who is now nearly 80, one of his eyes is just becoming quite blind, and he says, I don't expect my headlights to be in such good condition today like they were 80 years ago. That's a matter of finite existence. Now let's have a look at this mysterious language without which man cannot begin to think in the way he would like to think if he knew what it could do for him. It happens that all language is quite simply the function of the modification of a prime sound by altering the chambers in which the sound is produced. In the language of the Tao Te King, there is one spirit, or wind, blowing in holes. All the holes are of different sizes and different shapes. Means the individual existences of individual human beings can be considered to be conditioning factors or queer-shaped holes through which universal spirit blows. Now, we'll draw a hole. There's a triangular hole. Here's another hole. A semicircular hole. It's trying to stand up. If we blow a wind through a Toblerone packet, then the resonances inside that packet will not be the same as they would be in a semicircular one or in a nice tin of pan shine with the lid and the bottom knocked out. In other words, the conditioning factors which produce individuated sounds are quite simply the characteristic shapes presented by elementary geometrical structures. Now, if we examine this in relation to the human being, so I'm using it so much paper, there is a device in the economy of the human being, the vocal apparatus. There's a nice windbag down there with a tube up, special breath control device in the larynx, a direction of air for vocalizing, toning, another direction through the mouth for whispering, making non-voiced letters. When we look at this, we find that this is a highly adaptable resonance chamber. And if we examine the nature of the letters of the alphabet, we find we can, in fact, reduce them to simple geometrical shapes. If you hold the tongue flat in the mouth, so when you open your mouth, what you see is the arch at the back, and the tongue flat, it will pronounce the letter R. So you see that the letter R, as we write it, can be considered to be a diagram of the flat tongue in the mouth and the arch of the mouth. In square letters, we make it like this, when we use the straight lines. If you depress the tongue and pull it down, well it, round the lips, you pronounce the letter O. If you lift the tongue up against the roof of the mouth, till it's almost like a crescent, you pronounce the vowel A. If you press it up till there's only a very tiny little hole, you pronounce the vowel E. Now it becomes obvious from this that when we use the vocal apparatus for making sounds, we are really manipulating changes on a highly adaptable instrument to produce sounds corresponding with geometrical states of being, which states of being are stresses and strains within the organism. So if we say O when we are surprised, we are really stretching the being as far as we can to its limits, and it automatically tends towards verticality because it is flying away from the concept presented to it. It is surprised. Oh, if you say instead of E, that's a different kind of exclamation, and it means they've seen the point, really. It's rather clever. Oh is a pure surprise. You put them both together, it gives you the Yiddish word, read from outside to inside, sign of lamentation, hand to be placed on the side of the head, oi. If you read it from the inside to the outside, it says yo, which is the Hebrew for God, the affirmative part. Now we have the oldest name of God in the world is a row of vowels. I've left off the two absolute vowels, diphthongs, which complete the seven letter form, and put the simple five letter form, E, A, R, O, U. Don't anglicize these vowels, because the English vowels are largely diphthongs. We say A, E for A. We say O, U, O for O, which should be O. Use Italian vowels or French vowels or German vowels. Don't use English ones. The English people say E for this sign. It is A. They say I, R-E, for this letter, which is E. The E-A-R-O-O, pronounce it quickly, yow, and then you can spell it like this, if you like. Now this yow is an old name of God. You call it Yahoo, if you like Swift does, but he knows what he's talking about. The reason a row of vowels is used to symbolize God is because God is free spirit, and vowels are made by not interrupting, not stopping, not kicking or floating the air on the way out. So when you pronounce a row of vowels, you have really pronounced a series of geometrical things, which I will rapidly put underneath: a dot, a plane, a hemisphere, a full sphere, and a ball thrown through space. Now that is the geometry of those vowels. So that when you come to examine in a picture or in a work of art, generally, the meaning of things, you will find you are dealing with a sphere, O, with an equatorial plane, A, and the hemisphere, R, with another one, the negative hemisphere below, called gravity R, falling R, deprivation, without E, the dot in the middle, and the whole thing thrown violently through space, U. So that when you come to examine your concepts in the light of this fact, you see that the name Yo, which is pronounced by English people through a confusion of Jehovah and Adonai, two different Hebrew words, one of them having been given the points belonging to the other. When you pronounce this word Yahu, you're pronouncing the word Jehovah in its original form, serialized. But in infinity, these things are not said separately, they are said simultaneously. If you try to pronounce the vowel E, you will find you cannot make it clean. You can hear a very definite round sound in it that doesn't belong to it. This is because there is a little sphere where you're lifting up your tongue against the roof of the mouth. There's a little spherical place, so that the E becomes O. Now you can prove this very simply on a tape recorder. If you record at a very high speed the vowel E, and then slow it down progressively by re-recording, you will find that it is sounding like O. And if you do the same thing in the reverse way, record O, and then double up the speed, the vowel will change. When you increase the speed, it moves from U, O to E. When you decrease it, it moves from E to O to U. And that you can prove to yourself on your tape record. This means that every E is really U, every U is really E. Now the E, or dot, the jot in the Bible, means form, and the U means power. So Kabbalistically we say, there is no form that is not a power, and there is no power which is not formative. Now this is the identity of opposites in the pre-Babel language which we are now examining. Remember that in the book of Genesis it says that men were behaving so badly, so ambitiously, that God came and confused their speech. God did it, they didn't do it. There are 72 languages described by the ancients, most of them now lost. And these languages we can find by simply going back to the primary geometry. And when we do so, we rediscover the language that was spoken before man's ambition caused God to confuse man. Now, what does it mean to say that God confused man because of his ambition? Does it mean that there was a God set over against man, and that man was set over against God, and there were two beings, and that man was being ambitious in one place, and God was watching him from another place, and thought, I will go and confuse him? It doesn't mean that at all. There is nothing other than the paper waving. And one of the little wave complexes of that paper is a circle called man. Looks a bit like an apple, doesn't it? An apple will finish it off. This is man, the being that does all the applications in the universe. This man means evaluator, is simply the modifications of infinite power, where the modifications are engaged in reflexive activity, meditating on their source. In man, the infinite power of God, of supreme power, omniscient spirit, whatever you like to call it, that infinite power has precipitated a complex form called man. That form is now factually able to consider its origin. It is trying to discover who it is, what it is, where it's come from, where it's going to. So man represents the precipitated God. And this is a great mystery of the divine humanity of Christ. He is man as to his finity, and therefore suffers on the cross of the situation. As to his essential non-difference from the infinite power, he is God. The whole problem, theological problem of the nature of Christ, is seen dialectically in the fact that absolutely there is nothing other than God, and therefore if there is a finite, it is God finite in that place. And when we see this fact, we can see that the whole geometry of the sphere with its consequent vowel forms inside are involved, that is, in-willed, pressed in, into every individual man. Therefore, man is a god in little. When the rabbis accuse Christ of making himself equal to God, he simply quotes the Old Testament at them, "Is it not written, ye are gods?" Every man is a little god for the simple reason there cannot be anything other than God, absolutely. If there were, there would be a duality. Therefore, man is simply God modalizing himself in the manner called man, that is, evaluator of origins. Now, we see here that because of being is finite, it is deficient, because it's circumscribed. It has three main divisions, better leave a hole in the middle, and idea, feeling, and urge. Looks like a German trademark, Efu. The idea, feeling, and urge in this being are subject to three orders of stimulation. Those three orders, if you are not aware of them, can cause a schism, as they call it these days, a schism, to be more accurate, a separation of the functions of the being, so that the idea level of the being becomes totally estranged from the feeling level of the being, and both of them from the urge level of the being. So that a man can have an idea that he's a decent type, feel absolutely no compassion for other human beings, and proceed urgently to put a lot of jam on his bread when nobody's looking, without in any sense feeling inconsistent. That is caused by the departmentalization of his being, by these three orders of stimulus. The process goes on in here, which Gurdjieff calls self-calming, that is, telling oneself nice statements about why one should do this under the circumstances, considering there's nobody about. It doesn't make any difference in any case. Now, by means of this mysterious writing, we can analyze any proposition whatever. A few days ago, I meant to say a professor, a Scottish Kabbalist, James Bonaventura Heaven, who we first saw in this place, because you can find out where he lived, and he's written to the Vatican in the British Museum and so on. Then he found that he did exist, and he hadn't really done anything much. Then he found that he had done something, and in any case, he was a Scotsman. Blowing his Scottish trumpet. And one of the things he illustrated, wrote up on the blackboard, showing how foolish this mission was really, was a cubic alphabet called a cubic alphabet. Now, if you were to draw a series of squares and write a letter, you say in English, letter A, in the first column, and we'd make one of the columns for each letter. And then we'd write again here, A, B, C. And the same down here, A, B, C. Now, if we go down here, we want to spell a certain letter in the English. We need that one out, represented on this page. A, and we go down here onto this line, A, B, R. You could say it's an Latin prefix, and a word. From. In Hebrew, Abba means father. So if we say that in the Allah, then that was a bed. Yeah. Abba means father. And then we need me. We go down here to the Abba, the. And that means destruction. Now, by the addition of the letter D, which means division, into the word for father, suddenly father becomes destructive. And this he thought, and the other theologians there, thought highly amusing, tremendously stupid. Yes, how silly can you get? And then there's a statement, this fellow, along with other Kabbalists, believed, quite erroneously, that the use of language could help you to understand the universe. Now, in fact, the mere fact that he was lecturing and using a language, and assuming that his students were understanding anything whatever about the study that he had undertaken, refuted him. Because if language did not in fact, clarify the nature of the universe, he had no right to be there, and a university is a farce. I did not point that out to him at the time, because he was surrounded by friends. Now, the important thing is that if you understand the nature of these letters, you can begin to see the roots of words. And the roots of words are so determinant that if you get hold of the root of a word, and so that you can actively define it, you will release yourself from a whole group of stimuli which would otherwise determine your life course. You know what propaganda is, you know what advertising is. You've all probably read that book, Hidden Persuaders, by now. No doubt. Now, if you read any of the literature on mechanistic behaviorism, conditioned reflexes, and so on, you will find that millions of dollars in America and hundreds of thousands of pounds in England are being expended on research into conditioned reflex theory and its relation to the man in the street, who is going to absorb the commodities manufactured by these firms. In order to condition a man, you must be able to hit him with a stimulus. And you can hit him on the sexual level and food level, the primary urge. You can hit him on the disliking and liking level. Do you love your mother or girlfriend? Do you hate your daddy or brother? If you're a boy. And you can hit him on the rational level. Have you read any good books lately? This mode of analysis is used by advertisers and by political propagandists, and all the beings who don't know the rule governing this are called people. And we've defined people before, and we've defined public, and we've defined the poli, the poloi. They're all polluted by too much attention at the lower end, which causes the blood to migrate from the brain and the brain cells to be oxygen starved and to degenerate as a result. Now, the language that we are going to examine is concerned with the symbology. And we'll write the name of God again, E-R-U. I've written E at the top, the little vowel, the yod, because it means form, compaction. I've written R in the middle because it means aspiration. And I've written U down below because it occurs in the word U. Some man yours for me, for the mystic you could see. E-R-U is the name of God. We put the intermediate vowel, E, on the larynx and O on the stomach. We now have the divine man in his vowel form. The word vowel, of course, means bowel. And the noise that comes out of the vowel, either down or up, uninterrupted by compressions of the tissue structures, is called a vowel. So that the vowel E means a point or a form or an idea. The vowel R means energy of aspiration. If it's negative, it's energy of falling down. The vowel U means prime urge, primitive force, sexual urge, urge to food, and so on. The vowel A between E and R shows you that between E, the form, and R, the aspiration, something is going on, and that is feeling. And the larynx has a thyroid gland which is peculiarly related to the emotional life. It is on the level of the letter E, A. And the stomach department, looks like a ball if you don't watch it, is the comprehender of the whole thing, the thing into which you throw the matter which breaks down and then becomes a food or power urge. So the divine man in his free aspect is represented by vowels. But that's only part of the divine man, namely his free aspect. His bound aspect has the consonants. Consonants are letters that you sound with. They're consonant. Sound with the vowels. Again, we have a man. He has lips and teeth, palate, and on the lips he pronounces M, and he can float it into P, B, F, V. There's a name. The adjective is the lips. And because these are forward in the mouth, and the vocal apparatus is like the whole man. The forward part belongs to the head and is analytic and specific, the precision of P, and it tears the thing and chops it with the teeth and the dents, which Mr. Nurse knows all about. The dental or dental, from the root DN meaning to judge. When the teeth bite into a situation for analytical purposes, to trap teeth, and the tearers on the edge and then the grinders at the back, you are indulging in an analytical process. The nerve endings going to these teeth have certain connections with parts of the brain, so that if you do a lot of worrying, you can actually get trouble with these teeth. If you do too much analysis, you can get tooth trouble. This is one of Rudolf Steiner's favorite thoughts, that he had a lot. And as you're moving backwards in the mouth, you're moving nearer and nearer to the gullet, which is the belly department. So you can write in the mouth again, E, A, R, O, U. There is a man in the mouth, which is why Jakob Boehme says, "Behold, dear beloved reader, the secret is verily in your mouth and on your tongue." The tongue itself is zoned in a certain way. You can examine this at your leisure, experimentally. And it tells you information about things sweet, sour, and bitter on the different parts of the tongue. Sweet, sour, and bitter have to do with some of the planets. And they have to do with certain forces in your being. The sweet is the thing you like. The sour is the thing that puts you off it. And the bitter is the thing that reduces you to bits and clarifies your idea in the process. On the lips, then, you have M, the great secret letter, the sacred B, B, F, V. They're all letters to do with this final expression, this clarification. P, B. They're external things. On the teeth, you have analytical ones. T, D, and blow through T becomes S, blow through D becomes Z. Blow through T with a little flattening of the tongue. Th, and D, V. You have this in the word thin, F in thin, the TH in thin is unvoiced, but in the word then it is voiced. There's two kinds of TH, and sh, that's TH blown through, and je, as in the French, je, and in the English word azure, sometimes called azure, the tongue. So we have a lot of letters there, right on the teeth, T, D, S, Z. Just behind them and spread a bit, th, th, sh, z. Then on the middle of the palate we have L and R, although the Scots pronounce it R forward and the Germans pronounce it backward at the middle. When it's pronounced very forward, it shows a remarkable analysis intellectual. When it's pronounced very backward, it shows that the analysis is going on at the gullet level of power, which is why Montgomery always bubbles his arm. At the back we have K and G. So we've now got left H, the symbol of breath itself, the aspirate letter, and a letter N, pronounced here continuously, where the palate is moving towards the teeth. In Sanskrit you can pronounce this N along the palate in different positions, including NG, Nga. Might be pronounced something like it in the word horn. English, as opposed to nice, probably. We've now got the letters of the mystical alphabet. All you have to see then is the function of these things in the mouth. At the back of the mouth, you have the belly representative, and K and G. Now, all the unvoiced letters, like K, and letters sh, anything you can whisper, and those are unvoiced. But all the letters that you voice have M sounding in them. We draw a line under the unvoiced ones and we write underneath them the voiced equivalent. And when we voice it, we're adding M, and M means substance. So we have G is K plus M, G. In fact, in Greek, you sometimes find, well, Greek, PM is a way of writing V. V. Because you put the lips in the position of P, and you make the sound of M behind it, and it goes V. So I actually write it PM, which is phonetically quite ridiculous. Under the sh, we have z. Underneath, we have z. Underneath, we have z. Underneath, that, we have z. Underneath, we have v. Underneath, v. We've now got our consonantal structure with special cases added, H-M-N, the origin of the word human. And the mysterious letter N, which runs through here, means continuity of processes, and the linked letters, which can be either voiced or not voiced, L and R. They occur in a nice old-fashioned word, rule, and lord, which is the same word. Remember, you analyze these things primarily without the vowels, and then you put the vowels in as qualifiers. We know the function of these letters. K and G have to do with the gullet. Those on the top line have to do with the intellectual analysis of those facts. Those on the bottom line have to do with the substantial existence of those facts. So if you find a word, a nice simple word like gump, it starts off with a hard G, which means the bloke is fairly gross. That's already made with an M in it. It's got the oo from down the belly department in it. It has an exodose of M, which is substance, and then suddenly it desubstantializes itself and says again. So if you can imagine what it feels like to be a gum, then you've got the significance of this word. I don't think it's just an imitation word. It isn't, there aren't any. When there springs up in the minds of soldiers and front or engineers in their workshops strange primitive sounding words, they are true words springing out of the level at which they function, usually from down below. They are subject to proper analysis and they have significance. Now let's look at another word and see what happens if we write it on the two levels. Let's take the word philosophy. That's, we can voice the vowel or we can whisper it. We'll whisper it because the preceding consonant has actually got itself unvoiced. It's all whispering. That means that the whole of philosophy is an intellectual proposition. Now let's make another word. Bill, Oz, O, B. Sounds a bit Russian, doesn't it? What would this mean? It would mean that we'd have to get down to the ground to turn philosophy into below the B. Already it sounds a little heavily Germanically pedantic. If we make a change like this, we begin to feel why this thing has got a tradition behind it with substantiality. Don't be afraid of turning one letter into another. There's a phonetic rule that governs this. Part of it you may know as Grimm's Law, which is a very simple one for turning all the European languages into each other by a simple rotation of the consonants. If you have a P, you can turn it into a V. If an F, into a V. T, into D. And so on. So if we take the English word leather, and we remember that a medial TH in English is a D in German, and they don't use that letter A in the middle because they don't have our vowel problems, then the German word leder is the English word leather. That's part of the sound shift law. Now, whenever a people change one sound into another, it is because of a very deep need in themselves to express their being level. So we'll find in German strange terms that we do not find in French or English, which appear in Germanic philosophy. We can find a word like this, Urgrund. Now that Urgrund is a term which we don't find elsewhere. And the Germans are a people, like the word German suggests, the evaluator who breaks up their They're earthbreaker uppers. And so they like to get down to it. They're very fond of the word grunt. That means foundation, basic. The grunt sounds a bit different from basic. And the ur here means power differentiated, which is the ur in the original. So in Jakob Böhme's work, you will find the word urgrunt. And you will find ungrunt. Now, such terms are tremendously valuable because they convey a concept which you cannot convey in any other word. Every word is peculiarly itself, and it's for this reason that it is physically impossible to translate a poem from one language to another. You cannot translate a poem and retain its value from one language to another, because the essence of a poem is that its significance is involved in the sound. So if you change one sound to another, you haven't made the same poem in another language, you have made another poem. Poems are concerned with power substantialized. We now have a mode of analysis, which ties up with the other question. How are we to go to work to discover the forces acting upon us? We can do so by asking ourselves, when we feel that the stress is in the belly department, how many words can we find to express this state that use M letters, and its voice letters, and the back K and G. So we've got the intellective come, which is already hybrid, because K is intellective and M is substantial, and the substantial G and M, gum, gamma, and so on. How many words can you find that have functions of this kind in? Those have to do with the belly level. And if you take an old sense, I'll take the Persian form of it, looks a bit like a fellow at a football game. Now this word, M-U-G-H, yeah, or M-U-G aspirate, mug, is a mug, is mug, is substance, power, substantiated. It is the Persian word for magical power. Our word magic shows the U has become A, G is softened to J, and I, K, becomes intellective. Magic, from Mu, the primary development of belly power, as Zen exponent would say, Mu, U, G, primary will, driving towards its end, and everything it's got positing into it, has become in us m-a, substantial aspiration, softening of the effort, reduction to analytical points, intellectualization. Now, we can import into it a meaning and save it for our own sakes by saying a substantial energy, grossly established, particularized, clarified in the mind. That is magic, but it's really magic, and it's better magic. It's even better moogic. It sounds like a Russian moogic gone soft. When we find, using a dictionary, that the words that we are digging up to express what we feel predominate in back consonants and back vowels, know that we are referring to the belly region. If we find that the consonants and vowels are made in the middle of the mouth, it refers to the chest region. And if we find that the vowels and consonants are made forward in the mouth, it refers to the intellect. So you find our friend Bertrand Russell and company using forward vowels because they're intellectually analytic. So we see now, nothing is told to the deficient, but everybody is deficient. So if we are talking to beings, we must be talking to the non-deficient parts of it. What we're doing, in fact, is this. Inside everybody, there is an immanent spirit. Paul says our conversation is in heaven. Around that immanent spirit is the zone of deficiency. And we are talking now, when we're talking basically, from immanent spirit to immanent spirit, and we're hoping for a two-way traffic. so that the seeds of phonetic symbols shall fall on good ground. There shall be a real response determining itself in act into a definite attempt to feel the different levels of energy in the body and how they move from time to time, how an external stimulus can knock you out of an intellectual process to a consideration of your next meal, and to become aware of this shift of levels of energy which is going on in the body from external stimulation, and then to find those words that you can within your vocabulary that adequately express the feeling experience you have, and to see from the domination of consonants and vowels that the experience belongs at a certain level. By doing this, the whole process becomes clarified, and the thing is lifted up, and you are getting the sprach to feel the feeling for this primitive pre-Babylon language. As you become progressively more aware of the feeling of these sounds, so you get more control over your own being, and dialectically, so the distance between you and the other person who hasn't done so increases, which is a grave danger. If you get to know too much about it and become too familiar with it, you can, if you don't set up a special stimulus in yourself, forget that nobody else knows anything about it and start throwing precious pearls about, and then you will find that they are not appreciated as pearls, which resolves itself down into the superglyph of all yogis, which being interpreted means keep your mouth shut. Remember that deficiency is the property of every finite, but not to bother with the deficient finite. Remember that within the deficient finite, right in the center, is immanent spirit, which is in no sense deficient. To identify with that immanent spirit in yourself, to see that the external stimulus that disturbs your vehicle of deficiency cannot reach into the level of the internal spirit, and therefore it cannot be attacked, and therefore it is absolutely secure, and then to talk from your center of absolute security to the center of the same in another person, and thus bypass the zones of deficiency. That is the relation called truly personal. Whereas the relationship at the deficient level, the level of the merely material external stimulus response of being, is of itself unproductive, always dissatisfying, and certainly the producer of all the misunderstandings that exist in the world.
Some economizing and punishing going on.
If I drop it, it isn't my fault. We did a little last week about a triangle of relation, and we wanted to know why we hadn't done it before. And the answer, of course, must have been because we were busy doing something else. And this week we'll have a look at it. This triangle of relation has been used for a few thousand years, and it has been reworded periodically to bring it up to date. It is tremendously important. Karl Marx uses it, Hegel used it, Plato used it. The idea basically is that you have an observer looking down at two entities, A and B, and he's looking for something similar in A and B, intending to relate A and B by the similar he discovers. This particular symbol, the triangle with the eye over it, appears on the back of an American dollar, actually, where the triangle is disguised as a pyramid, the symbol of hierarchical power, the invert symbol of democracy. Every A and B, if relatable, must have something in common. If they have nothing in common, they cannot be related, and if they cannot be related at all, then there cannot be one observer. There would have to be an observer of A and an observer of B. And if there were no factor in A like B, A and B could not act upon each other, and therefore if there were two observers, one A and one B, the two observers could not communicate. So if communication is possible, it implies an identity of some order between the different parts of reality. Well, that's the original form of the glyph. We'll now draw it again. We will put on the top here reality and affinity and communication. I'll shorten it by two hours. Now the statement is made by most epistemologists that reality is simply the agreement of observers. For instance, I've drawn a triangle. If I say, is this a real triangle? I'm really saying, in shorthand form, do the sense organs of all the observers in this room perceive that which we mean by triangle? If there is an observer in the room who cannot see here three lines joined together in the manner that we call shortly a triangle, if there is somebody in the room who can't see it and sees instead a very beautiful advertisement for somebody's soap, then he will say that this is not real. We have said there is a triangle here. If he doesn't see one, he will say it is not really so for him. If we all agree that there is a triangle there, we will agree to use the word reality of this triangle. If there is anything in the universe at all that appears differently to every being, then it must have as many realities as there are beings perceiving it. We will accept this definition, then, that reality is simply the congruence of perception of all beings. So if we look into the universe and agree that there is a universe, what is happening in fact is that we are seeing stars in the sky, moon, planets, sun, aeroplanes, and so on. And if, when required to examine these things, our sense organs give us the same formal data, then we agree to call it real. Now, in order for us to perceive a reality and agree about it, then the observers of this reality must have something in common. We'll put down here two observers, A and B. If they agree on this reality, by our first law, that there must be an identity between A and B if they are to communicate, then A and B, if they agree upon the nature of the perceived reality, must have a natural affinity. That is to say, they must be formally, substantially identical if they are to perceive the same reality. Now, if they wish to convey to each other the fact that they are perceiving the same reality, they must communicate. And again, to communicate from A to B implies that there is something in A like something in B, so that B can respond to a stimulus from A. And if B is to reply, there must be something in A like something in B, so that B can stimulate A. So we see here that reality again implies the identity of beings, and affinity requires the identity of beings, and communication requires the identity of beings. When we look at this triangle, then, we see we're really concerned with identity of being. Communication is possible because there is identity of being. Affinity is actually the statement there is identity of being, and reality is the perceived identity of being. Now, there's an old statement that says, if we lift up one point of the triangle, we necessarily lift up the other two. This is very important for human relations. We look into the world and we agree that we have seen, in this case, a triangle. We agree on this, and the agreement establishes reality. If we see a triangle here, it proves something not only about the nature of the triangle drawn on the paper, it proves something about the perceptive organs of the people viewing it. Those perceptive organs must be of the same order, must function on the same level. If I get a tiny insect whose angle of vision may cover perhaps a 16th of an inch, and put it inside this triangle, it cannot judge that it is a triangle, because its angle of vision is too small to cover it. So for that little insect, if I were to talk to it in basic Esperanto, and say you are standing in the middle of a triangle, it would not know. It would have to take my word on authority, or reject it, believing that really there's no point of communication because there is no affinity. The fact that we can agree that we have drawn a line and another and made a triangle, therefore, says something not only about the thing drawn, but about the perceivers of the thing drawn. All perceivers at the same level of being perceive the same reality when presented with the same stimuli. They can communicate what they have seen only because they are fundamentally identical. If then we wish to increase communication between two beings, we must find an affinity, that is, a similarity, an identity in our beings. We must look for something that we have in common with the other beings. This is basic in educational theory. We go from the known to the unknown. We first say, do you know X? He says, yes, I know X. Then you say, well, X equals Y. And then you communicate Y by making an equation. If you can show that Y is identical with X, then you have communicated Y by starting with X. You go from the known to the unknown. So you go from a known affinity to the possibility of communication. And then, if the person receiving that communicated element, that stimulus, accepts it and checks back with you, then you establish a reality common to both of you. Because every time you can discover some point of affinity between yourself and another being, you have done two things at the same time. You have increased your capacity for communication, and you have raised your level of reality. On the other hand, if you couldn't find a point of affinity inside yourselves, and you wish to increase communication, you then look into the world of reality, the world of sense phenomena, and you indicate a given thing, X, and say, can you see X? If he says, yes, I can see X, you have established some communication and shown an affinity. So again, we have an easy mode of letting the general level. We indicate a reality when we cannot find any point of communication because we can't find any affinity. If, on the other hand, we want to raise the level of reality and we have an affinity, all we have to do is communicate that affinity. If we are in communication and can see some facts, and we want to increase our affinity, we state the facts that we can see, we communicate them, and agree that we have seen the same facts, and thus establish an affinity. Let's take an example in the case of the problem with the Calabar, which has been cropping up in the last couple of years fairly strongly. A theory has said that white men and black men are not the same. That is, they have no affinity, essentially. We point to the reality of the fact and say, well, they are bipeds, and they do show a certain capacity for rational activity. They can drive motor cars, fly aeroplanes, run about, do various deeds that white men can do. So by looking at the reality, the factual reality, we can indicate affinities, and that raises a level of communication. We can point out a basic one. If the black and the white people were totally dissimilar, then they could not breed together. The fact that they can breed together shows they have an affinity, a biological affinity. So then communication, being established, they produce progeny in the act of communing, shows that they have a basic affinity in the factors of heredity. And this establishes that reality includes these two as equivalents at that level. If we understand clearly this, we can begin to put it into operation in any real situation. If we state the elements in the situation to each other, we are communicating and establishing at that moment that there is an affinity between us. If, when we are in communication, we wish to raise our level of reality, we must indicate those things that we agree about, that is our affinities. And if we have actually felt an affinity, we can, by communicating the elements of the affinity, lift up our level of reality. So we say, to lift up one point of this triangle, you should lift up the other two. Now, supposing you are having a row with somebody, a disagreement. Now, a disagreement means you are pretending that the affinity is not what it ought to be. And consequently, there is a lack of communication. If there is no affinity and there is a lack of communication, there is a non-agreement about the nature of reality. So that if you have a very vigorous argument with someone and you have no affinity of terms, you cannot communicate your mental content and you begin to become unreal to each other. This is one of the most important aspects of it. If a man is arguing with his wife, he starts off by assuming that he is somehow different from her and she assumes she's different from him. They then start firing statements across the table at each other, and by careful disagreement they prove that there is no communication. And at this moment, wifey says, "You are becoming unreal to me," meaning the communication affinity level has gone down. We find this quite a lot in psychological practice, that the patient says, "Things are becoming unreal. Nothing seems real to me anymore." This simply means that in their attempt to communicate, they have not found points of affinity with other beings, and therefore their reality, which depends on communication of affinities, has gone down. So we have to then devise a method of proving that they have got affinity with other beings, and then we have to devise a symbology, a language, whereby their affinity can be communicated, and by discovering affinities and then communicating, we begin to travel up and become progressively more real. It's a very widely spread fact that the sense of unreality arises from failure to communicate or to discover affinities. Have we any dealt with before? Here are two people. There's the center of imminent spirit initiative. Here's the five sense life in both of them. Here's the intellectual life in both of them. And the fact that we can concentrate on any one of these levels can make us relatively unreal to each other. You said that an introvert. An introvert is a fellow who is cutting down on the messages from outside, reducing their intensity, and he is beginning to move inside. Now, you mentioned probably in the pathological sense, and therefore you did not mean a positive intellect preoccupied with the pursuit of yoga. So he has gone so far in, but not so far in that he discovers his pure intellect. He is therefore at a level where the memory impressions of previous sense stimuli are dominating his consciousness. So when he refers to anything, he is not referring to the external situation, he is referring to some mnemic situation from his past experience. Now, if he acts as if what he is talking about is real to him, and as a defined introvert of that order, he must do so, he will be talking individually and subjectively about his own inner states. So if you show him a certain kind of picture, he will say, "I don't like that picture." And he's thinking, "I don't like that picture because it's got the Andrew cross in it, And that, of course, means action, conflict, cross swords. He's telling you something about his own inner state. Another man who is extroverted, trying to communicate with him by referring to a given fact about X in algebra, not meaning the same thing, cannot communicate. He sends a message saying, concentrate X. But the introvert says X means an undesirable conflict. So the extrovert then says, this man is unreal. And this introvert is saying, this outside fellow, this extrovert, is also unreal. He doesn't know what I'm talking about or thinking about. So if we want to establish the communication and raise these, then the term extrovert-introvert can be employed. Jung used them in this sense and made some modification of psychological theory. We have to be very careful with them if we simplify the diagram a little and say we can have men whose energy flows out and men whose energy flows in. If we state this as a fact and remember to say to each other, are you extroverting on the physical world at the moment, or are you investigating some of your private fantasies? There's a rule in Brahmanism that says thou shalt not marry a red-headed woman. Now, you might go out and find a red-headed woman being very kind to children crossing the road. And you might say, well, there's kindness, I would like to marry kindness. If you were to investigate her motive for doing so, you might change your mind. You might not. If you're clear about what you're looking at, and you make the other fellow look at the same thing, then you can establish communication. Because again, you have a coincidence, and therefore reality appears, where you can make this coincidence of sense percepts. If you know a man to be introverted, and you go the right artist and explain to him that he is introverted, and better to avoid the technical term, because now there's an unpleasant sense of it, a sense of negativity, so you're a man of deep meditative powers. And then you say, now will you please meditate on this external fact? That avoids the negative suggestion of calling him a so-and-so introvert. If, on the other hand, you're coming up against an extrovert who insists that there are no realities at all other than external objects, the occasions of sense stimuli, then you require him to introvert himself and see if it is not true that he has sensations in his body that do not derive, nor ever did derive, from his five sense organs. We start life as an egg, and this egg has originally, apart from the nuclear envelopments, no parts. If it is stimulated in that stage, away it goes through its substance, and we call this total reaction a photopathic reaction, which is non-discriminate. It responds to touch, taste, smell, sight, and sound indiscriminately. Every human being has been such an egg and has gone through various stages, and it has always been a sentient substance. This means that prior to the development and separation out of our five sense organs, we have already got data inside us, and these constitute our basic feelings and feeling attitudes, non-analyzed. Now later on, there will be the construction of five special sense organs. And these, when stimulated, will give you confined reactions to specific frequencies and the total spectrum of the universe. Audio frequencies, video frequencies, and so on. But between each two senses, there is a large amount of tissue, not specialized, but still responding. This means to say, there is still inside us irrational, sub-rational, feeling response to stimuli. And the five special sense organs are trying to tyrannize over this protopathic level. But the protopathic level is very, very old, and it cannot be eliminated by special sense organs, because special sense organs are just little localized zones that have been evolved to a very high degree of formal complexity, but they have not involved the tissue between. So you cannot eliminate protopathic responses. So again, in considering the triangle of relation, we can say to a man who is aware of his sense organs and thinks that only the messages of the special senses are real, we can require him to admit this fact, that he has in his body many, many thousands of cells, not in the five special sense organs, that these cells respond to stimuli, and that from them arise pleasant and unpleasant sensations. And when we get him to accept this fact, again we raise the reality level. We can, by so doing, help him to see that he can have attitudes, sub-rational, of liking and disliking towards any situation, person or stimulus there is. In the same way, inside him he has the principle of pure reason, the either-or function, and we can refer directly to the principle of pure reason, that between a symbol A and another symbol different to it, to justify the use of two different symbols, we must refer to two different entities. And this is the basis of our intellect. We say that A is not A. And by so doing, we build up a logical structure that is quite independent of the five sense organs. Now, many a time, we will find that people, in trying to communicate, do not bother to discover their affinities. One can be working on the empirical sense level of the five sense organs, and he can be coordinating on the pentagon here those five sense messages, and thus making an empirical, statistical statement of reality. That is the kind of statement that a positivist would make, or a pragmatist, but it is not the kind of statement that a Platonist philosopher would make. A Platonist philosopher would say there is this pure logic, quite independently of the five special sense organs, and in fact predating them in the evolutionary sense, and actually constituting the mode of motion of absolute power. So if you then refer to what the man is saying, he's trying to communicate, and you say to him, are you talking from your five sense data, or are you talking from the level of pure reason, the six-pointed star? If you ask him to say this, and he thinks of it, he will then, we hope, know which level he's talking from. And if he does know, again you find points of communication. Now remember, through identification with different levels of being, we actually find much disagreement amongst thinkers. Even in the field of science, there are men who do not accept as science anything, whatever, except that which can be verified by the five sense organs. And there are others more thoroughgoing who deny that we can even establish the existence of sense organs, and simply say we must concern ourselves with sense data. And there are others that say we can't even call them sense data, we must call them events in consciousness. Now all this confusion arises from a lack of definition of the level from which you are talking. You can talk from your five special sense organs validly. You can talk from the interspaces between them, where your feelings are sub-rational, but not thereby invalid. You can talk from pure logic, the either-or, or you can talk from the coordination of your five sense data in that structure called the common sense. But if you omit to say from what level you are talking when you are talking with another person, then you are likely to be at cross purposes. If you go to a spiritualist seance and talk to a female medium, she knows that she is talking from a sub-rational level, from something in between the special five sense organs, and she has a feeling. If she's a good medium, she has faith in this feeling, because if she hasn't got faith, it stops working. Because if she hasn't got faith, it means she's shifted her attention into a part of the mind which acts as a critical sensor of this protopathic reaction. This is why in yoga, if you want to become whole, you have to become protopathic. And if you want to become protopathic, you must cut down on the mechanical judgments arising from the stimulation of your five sense organs. Now remember that the protopathic level is the next level, the highest level of the individual, to the absolute level represented by the paper itself. Let the paper represent the absolute and the modal function of the paper, the way it moves, draws a circle. And thus that circle is a vibration of the paper itself. Now the movements of the paper through it totally are the protopathic reactions of the individual. And they are total and they are whole. They are not analyzed. They are pre-analytic and therefore not synthetic. In a synthetic structure in the mind, you have first broken down the seamless reality by analysis, and then you add together the analyzed elements. So synthetic thinking aims at a whole of related parts, the parts having previously been analyzed. Whereas in the protopathic stage, you are experiencing directly through feeling a pre-analytic awareness of your own being. That pre-analytic awareness is only one stage different from the absolute, and it corresponds with the cosmic soul of the ancients, Anima Mundi. And by practicing, cutting down on the special sense data and their mnemic residual traces and their judgments assessed in the common sense, and then by cutting down on the logic of either or, one comes then to the protopathic whole awareness, and this whole awareness itself has these five sense organs within it, and all the mnemic data on top of, superimposed on this protopathic level, and then you become aware of the totality of your being, and in that state of equilibrated power of the whole, it becomes possible for there to emerge from the center of your being the awareness of your source in the absolute.
Isn't that case intuition protopathic?
Now you've introduced the word intuition. You can, if you like, use it in the technical sense, where philosophically intuitive knowledge is knowledge gained immediately without a sense organ. And this would bring it into a very, very similar level to the protopathic one we have discussed. Now, protopathic reactions have been demoted by biologists. This, you see, the amoeba, one that's about, and it reacts protopathically to a stimulus. But because it is very sluggish, and it's at our mercy, we tend to scorn it. Yet, at its own level, it is aware of itself in its medium as not to. It doesn't feel that it is totally separated from its medium. So that its life is, in a sense, confluent with the medium in which it lives. So if there is a chemical content in the water in which it lives, it feels and knows and responds to that as to its own being, because that water of its element constitutes its very being. So it knows its environment perfectly. Now, later on, the monocell begins to develop some other functions, and by gradual specialization of pigment, it will grow eyes, which are extra sensitive to light. Now, the amoeba is already sensitive to light, but not extra sensitive. They're not supersensitive. But when the supersense is put on and eyes appear, then the being reacts to a light stimulus that comes from beyond its own environment, from beyond the level of the water line. And at that moment, it can get out of phase with its own existence. If you respond to a stimulus from beyond your general level of awareness, it can put you out of gear with the environment in which you live. That's if you go to a political meeting with right-wing sympathies and you discover that the talker in that meeting is extreme left-wing, and you try to assimilate his ideas. When you go back to your conservative friends, they'll think you've been influenced. You have put yourself out of phase with your previous environment by opening yourself to a statement from another environment.
Let's take the life of the fish as a type of being that is aware of all the behaviour of the water in which it lives. If you go into that mysterious place called the Tower of Blackpool, there's an aquarium there, and you will see a tank full of fish which are blind. And there are many of these fish in the tank, and although they are blind and swimming about very quickly, they do not collide. Why do they not collide? Because every time a fish moves, the water moves around it. So that another fish here can feel, by the movement of the water, the proximity of another fish. So they are living in an element, and the movements of the element in which they live are the things to which they are responding, and therefore there is no collision. Notice there's no contingent relation there. It's analogous to feel the wind. And the same way, if we take a dicky bird, which is a bit like a fish and a beak on the end, this bird is very, very sensitive to air currents and to various fields in the air, and it can respond to air like the fish responds to water and its vibration. There have been a lot of experiments done by tying magnets under the wings of birds to test migration and so on. The fact is that as the fish responds to the movements of water, and the inner life of the fish is therefore a reflex of its environmental stimuli, so the life of the bird is internally one with the movements of the air in which it lives. Now, a man should live in another medium which we should not draw. We will say the natural environment of a fish is water, and of a bird is air, and of man is spirit, in its real sense. A man who is aware that there is a continuous power moving through all beings, if he can become aware of that power in the same way that the fish is aware of the movements of water, he can feel within that the movements that surround the fields of power of another human being, like one fish feels the movement of another fish through the movement of the water. If you change your mind about something, change your attitude about something, you have tuned yourself in. If you believe that there is a power field, and that you are modalities of that field, and that just as the fish can feel the water and the bird the air, so a man can feel this absolute field. When you believe that and start feeling for it, you will then begin to feel movements in the space around you, which movements, properly felt and evaluated, will convey to you information about other human beings with whom you're in proximity, just as those fish get information. So we then have modes of evaluating each other's reactions, of lifting up the reality level by discovering affinities and communicating the affinities, and we need this mnemonic device to remind us, to say, are you on the level of the physical, the gross matter? Are you on the level of the feeling, the water life like the fish, or the air life like the bird? That would be the ideal life. Or on the spiritual life like the man. And if you state clearly from what level you are talking, you can require the other person to go on to the same level in order to communicate. Or if he refuses to go on to the same level, to know that he is refusing. And thus at least you're proving some kind of reality, if only the reality of his refusal. And you can agree, if he won't go on to another level, to come on to his level instead, called beating him on his own ground. Because as long as you can establish an increase of affinity, a greater number of points in common, you have raised your communication possibility with him, and in so doing, raised the reality appreciation of both of you. And if all the beings in the universe were to agree about terms and agree about the perceptions they have, then they would agree about the total nature of reality.
When do you speak of intuition being the same as telepathic previously, and you talk about higher intellect, which I take it to mean geometric counting, really. That's so, that when you're using logic as the higher intellect.
Yes.
It is geometrical counting.
Yes, you're talking about the geometry of motion.
Yes. But that is not the same as intuition.
Well, here again, we've said that intuition, defined by the philosophers, is immediate awareness.
But what I wanted to ask is the counting of the higher intellect in order to analyze the immediate intuition? Or isn't that necessary?
No, it is a separate activity.
A separate
you would
activity.
Only use that if you wish to write a philosophy of immediacy. Remember, philosophy is concerned with a rational presentation, a worked out theory of something, and it must be rationally presented. Now, immediacy in its proper sense is that this paper is aware of itself, not through something else. Whereas the relation of perception in a mediated one is that you assume that there is an intelligence there and an intelligence there, and that this intelligence cannot communicate directly with the other, but it has to communicate across the substance which he must vibrate. And that substance itself is modifying the impulse that he's sending out, and therefore falsifying it. Therefore, every mediated stimulus is false, to some extent. And the only immediate experience is that of the absolute itself by itself. But in our illustration here, the paper knows that it is paper, and it knows that it is moving. That is immediacy. Whereas a mediated way, there is a communication of a force from one place to another across an interfering medium, and the medium distorts it. You get this if you try to translate a poem from one language to another. The man has experienced something in German. That means to say that the spirit working through a Germanic education has selected for itself certain Germanic terms to express its experience. It then posits a German poem there on paper. Along comes a bilingual expert who unfortunately learned English first, so that all his experiences have been filtered through an English vocabulary. So he has selected English words to express what he means. He now, with a second language, namely German, first thinks in English, then translates roughly by reference to the external world, the real world, what the approximate German word is. He gets the poem. If he finds that word, he then looks for the corresponding English word, and of course it hasn't got the same rhythm or the same rhyme. And he then produces a verse which he calls a translation of the original poem. Now, as we showed before, every time you change your feeling, you change your function, you change your form, you change the vowel and consonant structure which expresses it. So that a poem, if it is a real poem, is the exact objectification at the sonic level of an inner experience. If you try to translate this from one language to another, it is literally impossible. And the attempt to do so forces the experience, which is a matter of immanent spirit, across the mediating substance of the body through two different symbologies, and the result is distortion of a very, very high order. So that in fact, if you take even quite a simple German poem, although with a complex thought, say one by Heine, and translate the thing into English, it is not the same poem translated, it is another poem set up by the translator with profound and colossal nerve and defined as a translation when it isn't. Because it is impossible to translate in poetry, real poetry, because poetry is the objective expression at the sonic level of a valid immediate experience. And you reduce it to the mediated level when you try to translate it. Really, it's a question of the same thing we said before. You must say from what level you're talking. And the best thing for a person who wants to appreciate a poem in another language, or even a very deep philosophical thesis, is just to go and learn the language.
I know a particular German who's been learning English for 35 years. And he's been learning it because he wants to be able to think in English. He has recently said that he thinks now that he can think in English. But it requires a tremendous amount of work. It really means that he must displace the education he had for his first 23 years and set out a symbology closer to his essence, and thus displace the one that was originally placed there. In so doing, he actually becomes an Englishman, because he then becomes completely conditioned by the concepts that traditionally have embodied themselves in the English language.
So the musician in that case has a far better chance of communicating his experiences to the world in general than the poet.
Yes, because his experiences are more generalized. And what he communicates certainly communicates better, but precisely what he's communicated is very hard to determine. Does he communicate more than a mood? More than a mood is significance. If you see the proper study of mankind is man, the same about Pope, is a concrete statement, and it says what it means. But supposing you get a series of notes by Beethoven and some chord structures moving in a certain way, and you get a tremendous feeling that something's got to be done. Is this exactly the same thing as saying the proper study of mankind is man? Or is it something so universal that it becomes almost useless for any specific purpose? It may not be almost useless. It might be completely useless. It might be quite useful, like a military march. See, the fact that man has two legs is the cause of the time of military marches. If you tried to march to war in wartime, you would miss the third leg. There is a significance in music, but it isn't of the same order as the significance in literature and poetry. It's of a wider order and therefore less applicable in a certain sense. It lifts people out of the particular, which is why the ancient church, priests and so on were very fond of it. It lifts people out of the particular and makes them aware of larger issues, but it does not say what those issues are. Hence the accusation against priestcraft by left-wingers, who say that the use of incense and church music lifts an individual out of his individuality and then leaves him suspended and at the mercy of the next command of the officiating priest. Again, you have to say at what level you are communicating. Many a young fellow and girl have gone and listened to some beautiful music and shed a tear, probably Tchaikovsky or something, which causes tears very, very easily. And when they have felt this identical emotion, they have assumed, quite rightly, that there is some affinity in them. And then they have assumed, quite wrongly, that because of this affinity, therefore they should dedicate themselves together forever. But that's a misinterpretation of the fact of the affinity they felt. So that you have continuously to remind yourself of what level you're functioning on and what is the significance of that particular level. Otherwise you can increase affinities, enhance communications, show yourself a reality and then act on it, which isn't the whole of reality, and not the total of your affinities has been displayed. All propaganda work of a political nature is based on this triangle. If you want to go to another country in the great days of imperialism and conquer them, the first thing you do is study their mythology, their social and religious traditions and their philosophy. When you've got hold of those, you've got the ground concepts that determine their behaviour. Now, if you like to write those up on posters and say, "We, the gentlemen who love these ideas of yours, have come to release you, and therefore we are going to occupy all the posts needful to administrate the cash of this particular country." If you set up these statements first, the heads start to nod, "Yea, verily, those are our favourite ideas." And then the illogical statement, "The man who has just said he likes them must be a nice man." therefore we shouldn't really stop them sitting in our chairs. And that's absolutely basic in propaganda. To subdue any people at all, you study their mythology, their tradition, social structure, religion. And when this is completely absorbed, you then have many, many points of affinity, and therefore a great power of communication, and therefore you seem to them very, very real. If you read Montgomery's book on leadership, you'll find it saturated with that kind of elementary trick. Where on one page he talks about men as the raw material of his craft. The raw material. And he's thinking about them as material, just material, and he says so. But he's so straightforward, because he says, I'm an honest, straightforward man. And everybody likes an honest, straightforward man, therefore they must like him, therefore they must like being raw material. None of it is logical. He says he prefers the army, because you've got to do as you're told, to industry, where you have to be persuaded to do as you're told. And this kind of awareness in him makes him quite cheeky, because he is thoroughly aware of the nature of a conditioned reflex. On every page he throws in some stupid little anecdote for which his higher critics slap him and say he shouldn't talk nonsense in the middle of a serious book. And he's thrown that in as just a little stimulus for any stray, careless reader who will be delighted with the anecdote. He doesn't aim at strict logical accuracy throughout the book. The book is full of inaccuracies, inconsistencies, self-refutations. And yet it produces a general effect that he's a very, very nice man who loves humanity and knows it to be good raw material for high purposes. It's worth reading to see it and to look through it for the amazing number of inconsistencies. And it shows you a man with a very alert mind and a very low opinion of the readers that he's written the book for. But he does have the grace to say they are material. And if he said, dear reader, you are part of the material, and I, as a leader, must have followers, and this means you. The reply to the book, which I've written the title of, and I'll probably get Roy to have the book later, it is called the Path to Followership, where all the qualities defined for a leader are written down and then rubbed out. So that if decision is a quality of leadership, then indecision must be a quality of followership. So if you want to qualify to be a good follower, you must be insincere, unaware of the nature of the human being, incapable of a decision, have no proper application, lack concentration, etc., etc., etc. And if you can say you've got all these, you are then ready for your diploma in followership. Shortly, we'll repeat again. Do say at what level you're communicating, because only if you state the level can you come to an agreement. Most disagreement in science and philosophy comes from this simple fact that a group of men arguing on the basis of a five-pointed star, like the one on the flag of the USSR and USA, are saying we base ourselves on the use of our five sense organs. We are empiricists, extrovert materialists. And they're always arguing with another bunch of fellows, the philosophers, who use a geometrical structure which they assert, basically and openly, is prior to the appearance of the five-pointed star, prior to the appearance of your special sense organs, and rooted in the very laws of motion of the universe itself, the logos of the Greeks. And then there's another kind of thinking called Christian thinking. And in this, quite simply, the statement is, I and any passive being that I come in relation with. The vertical, the active, and the horizontal, the passive. In any relationship between two beings, there may be one passive and the other active in relation to any given concept or any given level of being. If you know this, you can be consciously passive, where you don't know the subject matter and thus acquire some knowledge, or if you do know it, then you can present it. But if you know both of them, you will know that if you are presenting it, it's quite probable that the others have gone to sleep. You see, the use of a symbol controls the level of the discussion. If we take the old swastika which Hitler borrowed, it is derived from an old grip of the sun with its arms coming up and signifies revolution. If it goes around Widdershins, it means revolution of an evil order to destroy, and if it goes around the other way, revolution for a good purpose. By using such geometrical symbols, you can control the level of your discussion. You must say, if you are trying to lift up the reality level with another person, at what level you are talking. In terms of shorthand, you can say, I'm talking in terms of 5 point or 6 point, or on the cross, or if you like, on the swastika, although that's out of fashion. Don't mention it. Notice that the double square one is a Muslim one, and it tells you about the nature of the material world. It gives an eight-pointed star. The material world lapped on itself as a dialectical thing, that there are diversities at the material level. And another very great element for them is the moon, which is to remind you that things wax and wane. Every time you use a symbol of this order, you can help yourself to keep control of the level at which you're talking. You can refer to the five sense data, if you stress the pentagon in the middle, to the coordination of that data. And there's quite a difference between the two. Those scientists who believe only in sense data refuse to add it up. They refuse to make a hypothesis. They never make a theory. They say quite simply, let us collect sense data, and let us just use sense data, but don't let us formulate a theory of sense data, nor a hypothesis about sense data. Just let's keep using them. They're right on the tips of the star. Some others say we can afford to coordinate sense data because it accelerates the process of science.
Does that mean they don't make a decision on the tips?
No, they just collect data.
What then?
Well, there are some other people that are very fond of the data they collect and don't accept their principle, but they accept their data. Now, in the case of these pure geometricians, you will find that the top-ranking mathematicians of the world don't like merely accepting sense data. They insist that sense data are forms of motion and that the laws of the propagation of motion are geometrical, subject to geometrical analysis and mathematical statement. Fellows like Alfred North Whitehead and so on. Those people consider themselves superior to these people because in point of evolutionary development, it can be demonstrated that before there was a five-sense orbit on the Earth, there was a sphere of protoplasm which approximates nearer to the purely geometrical structure that they use as their basis. And if we go back to the laws of motion themselves, and complete our wheels, as we have done so often, we can find that we have a mode of analysis of all things in terms of motion propagated from centres, and the motions from those centres overlapping and mutually interfering and giving rise to the sense data at the point of intersection. We can explain sense data in terms of the laws of motion. We cannot explain the laws of motion in terms of sense data. Now, if A explains B and B does not explain A, A is superior to B.